Thank you, Daniel. The last time anybody ever left something behind on the Northwestern in Chicago goes back to a story when, 1972, I took a leave of absence as Phil Crane's administrative assistant to be his campaign manager out here, and Kathy Ross, who is in the audience tonight, she assured me at the time, inadvertently, left a memo from me to her about our forthcoming election, re-election campaign for Crane, in which I said that one of our objectives must be to erase the memory of Donald Rumsfeld permanently from the mind of the people of the 12th District of Illinois. That was on a Tuesday. On the Sunday, it was on the front page of the Sun-Times, and Don Rumsfeld reminded me of it last night. So I think you're doing me a favor by leaving things on the Northwestern, Dan, but I'm not sure. And actually, mandate for leadership was, I had a little something to do with it, but the guy who really put it all together is here tonight and is, I think, a hero to all of us. That's Chuck Heatherly. And if you're wondering what the acting administrator of the Small Business Administration has to do with Central America, I will tell you. Because Chuck, who on the first day in office, with a typical, delicate, fine scalpel's edge, fired 7 Reagan appointees who were regional administrators appointed by his predecessor, Mr. Samson, did so by calling them the Samsonistas. And the allegation was they were perhaps not quite as committed to Ronald Reagan's program as was Mr. Heatherly, an allegation which none of them have denied, but nonetheless some of their political patrons still seem to be hanging with him. But unfortunately, we here in the Philadelphia Society don't admit such traitorous people to our midst, except in the case of tonight's featured speaker, who was, in 1967, not many years ago, the national chairman of Campus Americans for Democratic Action. It got worse. 69, he graduated from Harvard, 70 from the LSE, 73 from Harvard Law School. But then things started to pick up. He went to work for Scoop Jackson, fell under the influence of the good Richard Pearl, in 75, 76, went over to Pat Moynihan as special counsel, then as chief of staff. This was back when some of us thought there was still hope for Moynihan, despite the fact that he had done nasty things to our dear friend Jim Buckley. Anyway, for Moynihan, he was chief of staff. Having failed in that role, unfortunately, he returned to the private practice of law, where he was soon doing very, very well and able to re-enter the political fray after just a year or so, when he found a political godfather, if you will, in the form of Bill Timmons, a Washington lobbyist who, to many of us in this room, is suspect for certain young Republican activities he engaged in 27 years ago. But Abrams, in 1980, had the distinction of being a token Democrat, and this was when I first met him at the campaign headquarters out on Columbia Pike in Arlington, Virginia. He tried, actually, and I know this, before the election, he tried to re-register as a Republican, but Timmons, Meese, and various other people inside the campaign refused to let him because he was one of the real registered Democrats around the place. Well, that was fine until November 5th. However, on November 6th, when it was rumored that Abrams might get a job, Jesse Helms and various other people were descending on him for his political impurity, shall we say. But somehow, in there, he did re-register. He and I came together about that time through the intervention of a former distinguished senior member of this society, Frank Shakespeare, who assured me he was somebody I should know and get to work with. And I had that privilege in the fall of 1980 and spring of 1981 when he and I were together in various transition activities. And I came not only to know him, but to admire him immensely. He really charted a new course for the Agency for International Development, the Foreign Aid Program. I have to say it, Elliot, that it's not your fault that Mr. McPherson did not follow that course, but the paper was there and the direction was there, and hope springs eternal on AID. Shortly afterwards, Elliot Abrams, in the first Reagan administration, had the distinction of being nominated, unanimously confirmed by the Senate, and sworn in as the youngest Assistant Secretary of State in the history of the United States, serving in 1981 first as Assistant Secretary for International Organization Affairs, the body that oversees a number of perfidious activities like the UN and UNESCO and things like that, when he managed, among other things, to convince the United States to take a single solitary vote against the UN's position in favor of worldwide legislation on infant formula, something that I'm sure would not have affected the United States in any event, because since that time he has sired three children. In just 7 or 8 months later, he was tapped for his second job, that of Assistant Secretary for Human Rights, where he, in fact, performed yeoman's work around the world in a quiet, low-key, but extraordinarily effective way for real human rights progress. Then, just 8 or 9 months ago, Secretary Schultz asked him to take over as the Assistant Secretary for Inter-American Affairs, certainly one of the real hotspots inside the State Department, and for that matter, inside the entire government. Elliot, in the meantime, has found time to write for Policy Review, for commentary, for the public interest. He is going to speak to us tonight under the title Intervention in Latin America, Cuba See Yankee Know, and it is my pleasure to present to you at this time Assistant Secretary of State Elliot Abrams, the man Phil Donahue loves to hate.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ed. That's a very kind introduction. I should begin by saying that I had thought some time ago to speak tonight about democracy, about the export of democracy, about our efforts through, for example, the National Endowment for Democracy to bring the benefits of our system of government beyond our borders. Given the experience we've had on Central America in Congress in the last few weeks, I sometimes wonder what it is we are doing in trying to export this system to poor, unsuspecting third world countries. So instead, I want to talk about intervention in Latin America. It seems to me a kind of a hot topic and a useful one to, especially to take a look at right today, because yesterday, as I think many of you know, was the 25th anniversary of the Bay of Pigs, 25th anniversary of the landing at the Bay of Pigs. And that's been remarked upon in a lot of newspapers, even some TV networks. What has been less noticed is that tomorrow is also an anniversary, April 19th, of, among other things, it's the 14th anniversary of the founding of the M19. M19 is the armed communist insurgent group in Colombia. Everybody, or a lot of people, noted the Bay of Pigs anniversary, but the M19 anniversary is not big news. I want to argue that it ought to be big news because it is as salient to our concerns today as the Bay of Pigs. The Bay of Pigs was actually a single episode, a tragic episode. In a sense, a single tragic episode in a struggle conceived of by Fidel Castro when he was still in the hills, then begun outside Cuba with a now nearly forgotten effort to overthrow the government of Panama in April 1959, 2 years before the Bay of Pigs invasion. It was, of course, a tragedy because brave men were left to suffer the consequences of our ineptitude. For the last 25 years, commentaries on the Bay of Pigs have focused mainly on the presumed evils of U.S. intervention, largely overlooking the fundamentally interventionist nature of the Castro regime. You're familiar with these criticisms. Were it not for the United States, Latin America would be free of dictators, free of exploitation, free of conflict. If the United States would only stop intervening in Latin America, the litany goes on, Latin America would be democratic and prosperous and at peace. Those of you who are familiar with the works of such eminent Latin American historians as Tom Wicker and Anthony Lewis are familiar with this view. And in fact, if you deviate from it, you are immediately suspended from membership in the Latin American Studies Association. The history, though, of the M19 group demonstrates where the real threats to democracy in this hemisphere come from. And most people have never heard of the M19, but it is interesting because it is characteristic of the pattern of anti-democratic intervention that has afflicted this hemisphere since 1959, since Castro came to power. So let us take a look at it for a moment or two. It illustrates how Cuba tries to and succeeds in literally getting away with murder. Colombia is, in fact, one of the oldest practicing democracies in Latin America. It has a free press. It has a two-party political system. It has regular competitive elections. It meets all of the standards. The M19 is a terrorist group whose record includes holding a U.S. ambassador hostage, murdering 11 Supreme Court justices in Colombia, protecting and engaging in narcotics trafficking, and killing hundreds and, in fact, probably thousands of Colombians. It has consistently received Cuban support, Nicaraguan support, training, and arms. And, of course, some of this support goes through the drug traffickers who the Cubans cooperate with and, in turn, support. Let's go back to 1980, when that takeover of the Dominican Republic's embassy in Bogota took place. They took 80 hostages, including the U.S. ambassador, 14 other ambassadors. And the siege and the holding of those ambassadors lasted for 2 months before a settlement was negotiated. What happened to the guerrillas? Where did they go? Cuba, where they were released and given asylum, and they released their hostages. In the months that followed, Cuban intelligence officers arranged meetings of M19 leaders with leaders of other Colombian communist and terrorist groups and with Sandinista representatives to attain a kind of unified Latin American guerrilla movement. They imported a second group of M19 guerrillas from Colombia to Cuba to join the old comrades from the Dominican embassy takeover, and they got 3 months of military training by the Cuban army. Explosives, automatic weapons, tactics, communications, and of course, politics and ideology. So in 1981, they were ready, and in February, between 100 and 200 M19 guerrillas infiltrated Colombia by boat to establish a people's army. The operation was dismantled in a couple of weeks by the Colombian authorities. Among those captured was the M19 leader who had directed the embassy takeover and then fled to Cuba. His name, it's an interesting thing, his name was Rosenberg Pabon Pabon, and I wondered as I looked at the calendar, if he was a young man, he was born late 40s, early 50s, and one can wonder who he was named after. The M19 persisted. In 1983, President Betancourt introduced his peace process, and they gave lip service to it, but what did they do? Of course, they continued to arm and to recruit new members. 10 months after they signed this peace agreement with the Colombian government, they launched an all-out offensive in southwestern Colombia, and they killed several hundred people. Come to 1985, November, last November, heavily armed M19 commandos drove a truck into the basement of the Palace of Justice. They took a number of hostages, but they also just killed large numbers of Ministry of Justice employees as they came across them. It took about 24 hours for the government to get control of the building. And in that time period, the guerrillas had killed roughly 100 people, including 11 Supreme Court justices, a majority of the Supreme Court. Interestingly, this was not random killing. The terrorists had looked for particular Supreme Court justices to kill and particular records to burn, the judges and the records connected with drug trafficking. So this terrorist group was working in this operation not simply for political goals, but at the behest of the drug traffickers. Where did the weapons come from? Examination of the weapons revealed that they came in large part from Nicaragua. Some of them had been left in Vietnam in 1975 by us and had been sent by the Vietnamese to Nicaragua. Some of them had been given by the United States to Somoza and then left behind by Somoza and taken over by the Sandinistas and sent in. Others had been given by Venezuela and Colombia and other countries to the Sandinistas and then shipped in. Parenthetically, the Sandinista reaction to this was rather extraordinary and is worth mentioning. This being the takeover of the Palace of Justice, the Colombian army storms it, takes it back over, 100 people are dead, including the M19. Sandinista reaction, there was a special mass for the M19 martyrs who were killed in this operation, attended by Minister of Justice, Minister of the Interior, Tomas Borges. The reason I mention this M19 story is that it is not an isolated case, it is typical. Cuba's been doing this since 1959 with steadily increasing sophistication. And since 1979, there is a new pupil, Nicaragua. For example, Nicaragua and Cuba together now have been sending in guerrillas to try to knock off the government of Honduras. There's a man named Reyes Mata, Jose Maria Reyes Mata, who is a Honduran radical activist, who went down to Bolivia with Che Guevara in 1967 in that ill-fated attempt. In April 1980, he was arrested in connection with pre-election violence and kidnapping some Americans in Honduras, freed in a general amnesty the next year, and where did he go? Times change. They don't all go to Cuba anymore. He went to Nicaragua. And from there, he started this new campaign against the government of Honduras, recruits from Honduras sent to Cuba for training, and then start going back into Honduras to try to foment rebellion there. In 1983, July, Reyes Mata led a 100-man band from Cuba back to Nicaragua into Honduras in the isolated, kind of sparsely populated department of Olancho to try to get People's War of Liberation going. It didn't work. They were reported by the peasantry to the local police and army, and in the ensuing struggle, Reyes Mata was killed. Other guerrillas who were captured alive gave detailed descriptions of their training in Nicaragua and Cuba. Another attempt was made in July 1984 and 1985, and so it goes. So it goes, these Nicaraguan and Cuban attempts. Most recently, about a year ago, more Cuban and Nicaraguan efforts to get into Honduras. Well, I haven't even mentioned, I should say, in discussing intervention by Cuba and Nicaragua, the help of the Sandinistas for the Salvadoran FMLN, which is the largest single case. But one doesn't even need to talk about that well-documented case to reach this subject of Cuban and Nicaraguan intervention. It is incredible, but it is true that this is still denied by significant numbers of people in this country, including in the press and in Congress. Some people just simply deny these interventions have ever taken place. Hard to believe, yet let us recall that just a few weeks ago, the reaction of a large number of members of Congress was to deny that there was a Nicaraguan invasion of Honduras. In fact, until Ortega himself changed the party line and admitted that there had been an invasion of Honduras, a significant number of members of Congress were saying there had not. There's another response. Everybody does it. It's not a big deal. It happens all the time. Why is the Reagan administration making such a big deal about this kind of standard Latin practice? Why take it so seriously? And then there's another reaction, which I particularly love. Cuba and Nicaragua are small and poor countries, and therefore this activity is not intervention by some definition. It's internationalism, or it's best of all, Latin American solidarity. These reactions are wrong, and they're wrong because they miss the key strategic point. And the key strategic point is This is not a local phenomenon, and it is not a Cuban phenomenon or a Nicaraguan phenomenon. It enjoys the full support of the Soviet Union, which is acting here through its proxies and its allies in the Western Hemisphere. Castro, we know, had long seen Soviet power as the means to, in his words, transform the Andes into the Sierra Maestra Mountains. But it's an interesting historical fact. During the 60s, the Russians opposed and restrained many of Castro's activities. In 1959 and the early 60s, Castro tried armed expeditions or tried to foment the armed overthrow of the governments of Panama, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, Guatemala, Colombia, Venezuela, Peru, and Bolivia. But the Soviets were a little bit suspicious of this policy of inciting armed violence. They were still working through the old line Moscow-oriented communist parties. And there was actually disagreement between the Soviets and Castro on this point. Castro feeling there was not sufficient support for national liberation movements. What changed it was Africa, especially Angola. Cuba's operations in Angola and then Ethiopia persuaded the Soviets of Castro's military value to them. In areas of the Third World, where the Soviets were under constraints that were not binding on Cuba, the Cubans could portray their actions as an outgrowth of their own foreign policy, as support for local national liberation movements. But let's be clear, Castro's activities, these very extensive and costly overseas activities, would have been impossible without the support of the Soviets. The Cuban armed forces, now a quarter of a million strong, with the newest sophisticated weaponry from the Soviet Union, became a formidable offensive military machine. And today, Cuban intervention plays an absolutely key role in Soviet global strategy. Cuba provides the missing link between Soviet power and indigenous conflicts, transforming what previously would have been purely local conflicts into the East-West arena. When Cuban pilots fly Soviet helicopters against Nicaraguan peasants, it's not the United States who is injecting the East-West conflict into Central America. It's the Soviet Union. Beginning in the late 70s, Cuban support for violence really increased dramatically, particularly in Central America, but in South America and the Caribbean as well. From Nicaragua and El Salvador to Colombia to Guatemala to Grenada, thousands of people have died because of this Cuban intervention. And obviously, the struggle to build democracy in these countries has been made infinitely more complex. While this was going on, what were we doing? We were trying to support the expansion of democracy, trying to support the expansion of trade, and increasing significantly our own economic aid. But if you listen to most of the press and much of the Congress, people talk and behave, more important, behave, as though they cannot even see the Cuban and Soviet role, but can see very plainly every single imperfection in the U.S. cooperation. Now, how is this double standard explained? How is this phenomenon explained? Is there really anyone who's unaware that Cuban subversion in this hemisphere inevitably prepares the way for Soviet power? I doubt it. There is a polite fiction here that no doubt serves its purpose. The Soviets exploit Castro's violent zeal because they know that a direct Soviet role in this hemisphere would meet stronger opposition, both in the United States and throughout Latin America. The most liberal members of Congress profess their readiness to send in the Marines if the Soviets dare to build a military base in Nicaragua, in addition to the one the Soviets already have in Cuba. So the Soviets need to be a little bit careful. They need to use a little, just a little, sleight of hand to carry out their objectives in the Western Hemisphere. The Cubans have less to worry about in this regard. They are shielded by this polite fiction that they are an independent Latin actor on the Latin stage. The fiction that the Soviet Union is not involved in Cuban interventions is necessary for certain people. It is necessary for those who, for whatever reason, want to avoid the difficult question of how to confront Soviet intervention in this hemisphere. And it is also necessary for those who have no choice other than avoidance because they simply don't have the means to defend themselves. Let me give you an example. One Latin American leader, in a private conversation with me, described the Sandinistas so accurately, exactly as the president would have described them, that I said to him, "Why does your government not ever, ever say any of this publicly?" And he said, "Look, do you think that they cannot switch on the student riots and the street demonstrations and the strikes in 1 minute?" So, being new at diplomacy, I foolishly said, "Who is they?" And he looked at me as if I were an idiot and said, "Cuba." Even he was too careful to point out that they can not only switch on strikes and street demonstrations, they can go beyond this into the M19 type of murders as well. In short, given the time and the opportunity, they can stimulate what seems to the ill-informed to be an internal war. And the notion that democracy guarantees immunity from subversion is disproved by a case like Colombia. Neither the Latins nor we can risk failing to see the real danger. But here I want to turn back to this question of avoidance again. What's going on? Why is it that so many people refuse to confront and to acknowledge this fact of Soviet intervention in the Western Hemisphere? I think the answer is something like this. If you call the effort to consolidate communism in Nicaragua a local conflict, then you can oppose U.S. intervention in a local conflict. If you call it a Latin issue, then you can urge, and this is basically the Democratic Party's position, you can urge a Latin solution. But if you call it what it is, an effort by the Soviet Union to become the dominant power in the region that lies between the Panama Canal and Mexico, then whose responsibility is it to act? Only the United States has the power to deal with the Soviet Union. Once Soviet intervention is acknowledged, we do not even have a responsible option of remaining aloof. The fact is that right now we are partly involved and partly aloof. We do help a great deal through intelligence sharing and military training, military assistance, and we did, for example, in Grenada, help save that island through force of arms. Yet at this moment, thanks to the Democratic leadership in Congress, our humanitarian aid program to the Democratic Resistance Forces in Nicaragua has expired on March 31. And for 2 years now, we have given them nothing by way of military assistance. When we ourselves are unable or unwilling to act, I really think it is unfair to criticize, as many of us do, Latins who refuse to stand up to the communists on the issue of Nicaragua. If we will not stand up to this Soviet intervention, they will not get out in front of us. We are the great power in this hemisphere. And like it or not, the responsibility for protecting this hemisphere from the subversion of an extra-hemispheric great power is, in the final analysis, ours, not that of the Latins. Let us not excuse our own indecision by hiding behind the uncertainties of our hemispheric neighbors. Latins, too, know about avoidance. If whatever our words, whatever our rhetoric, if we accept a communist, subversive, repressive Nicaragua as our newest neighbor, so will they. So will the Latins. And indeed, much Latin diplomatic activity in recent years has sought to define the terms of the accommodation. But Latin leaders, when you talk to them privately, and more now, know Nicaragua. They know who the Sandinistas are, and they know what they stand for. They know about that attack on the Palace of Justice in Colombia. They know what has kept the Salvadoran guerrillas in the field, even though it has no popular support. They know all about the repression in Nicaragua. They know Managua is a terrorist base. They know that Nicaragua is a Soviet ally in this hemisphere. And they even know who is torpedoing the Contadora talks. Many Latin American governments are struggling with two problems. First, the tension between their traditional historic fears of U.S. intervention and their realization that U.S. cooperation is vital to resist Soviet intervention. And second, and this we do not sufficiently recognize, I think, second, the concern that the firmness needed in Washington to resist effectively may, in fact, be wanting. The conclusion that our role is essential but missing can produce the same phenomenon of avoidance again. And if that conclusion means disaster, then it's only human for many of the Latins to avoid that conclusion by reaching instead the conclusion that perhaps, after all, the United States is not needed and there can be a Latin solution. But if the United States is clearly active, if we're ready and willing and able to defend our friends and our interests, all those calculations change. Soviet and Cuban plans and activities have to be reviewed, as they were reviewed after Grenada. Latin American views about likely winners and losers, likely patterns of stability and instability, likely rewards and punishments to those who resist and those who subvert, all change. Put less theoretically, it is easier to accept Sandinista aggression as inevitable if you think the United States will not oppose it. But it is also easier to conclude and to say publicly that Sandinista aggression is intolerable if you think the United States will, in fact, not tolerate it. So we return to fundamentals. The Soviet Union is actively intervening in this hemisphere. Through Cuba and Nicaragua, the Soviet Union has become a major actor in a region that extends to our southern border and is clearly vital to our security. This intervention must be admitted, and it must be resisted, and it must be defeated. If we are weak or indecisive, we will rally no one to our side. In Latin America, the now familiar pattern of criticizing whatever we do as a half measure, while at the same time steering clear of commenting on Cuban behavior, will continue, and it will be repeated again and again. But if we are resolute in identifying and coping with the problem, the very clarity and firmness of our position will influence both the problem and the way it is perceived. And it will help to win the support of many among those whose future depends on how the problem is resolved. And that includes people inside Nicaragua and people right here in the United States, as well as the rest of the Americas. Thank you.
Stand back.